and getting some perspective on it. I like to tell the story that after our Civil War in the 1860s here in the United States, that my great-grandparents went across from Georgia in covered wagon with a team of horses and a few head of cattle to open up the western frontier and become ranchers and cattlemen in western Texas, eastern New Mexico. And that was in the 1880s. And I noticed in our first presentation that we got a first look at the Arctic area in the late 1890s. And then Amundsen at the South Pole in 1911. Powerful new exploration after centuries of not really knowing what was there. And when my great-grandparents went across the West, railroads had not been built across the United States. They were in the process of being built from the East Coast to the West Coast. Automobiles had not been invented. My father was born in the year the Wright brothers made their first flight. And I went to the moon. 100 years from covered wagons to going to the moon in our lifetimes. And I will point out here that, as Tim pointed out in his presentation, we have over 6 billion people on this planet right now. At the beginning of the 20th century, there weren't even 3. And I will say, as of today, we have over 6 billion people, and half were not born when I went to the moon. So we live in a time of enormous acceleration, enormous change, and all that we're talking about here with digital Earth and the many aspects of modern life is the rapid change brought about by science and technology and discovery that has happened largely in the last 100 years. And with that, now, oh, and one more thing, Buckminster Fuller correctly pointed out at the beginning of the space age, that we are the crew of Spaceship Earth, and we're a crew in mutiny. And how do you run a spaceship with a mutinous crew? And that's really the problem we have, learning to pull it together, to integrate it, to make it work for all of us and for all of civilization and for nature is the challenge that we find before us. With that, I'd like to tell you a story of going to the moon, and that's my story and my history. So with that, let's move ahead, and you will see this amazing picture that was taken from the Apollo spacecraft on the way back from the moon. This particular one was taken on Apollo 10, and it's the only one where we really had a good, had the sun directly behind the spacecraft so that we got a full picture of Earth from deep space with the sun behind the spacecraft, so we had a full Earth as we look at it. One of the best pictures we have of Earth from space. Let's see. Tim, I'm trying to click that and it's not going. Oh, wait a minute. Where's that going, coming from? Back up here. Okay, there's where. That's it. There we go. Okay, the trip to the moon, and it's my story. And this starts out in the early years in 1934. And as I pointed out, I grew up on a ranch in West Texas and then eastern New Mexico. And that was to be my destiny, my future, with my first pony, and that picture was taken in 1934. Now, the main thing about that particular pony and that particular rope is I decided I was going to be a cowboy. And one day while my father was building fence, I went running down the fence line on the horse at full gallop and roped a fence post. And to the dismay of both of us, because me and the pony ended up on the ground with that one. He was not a proper roping horse. Anyhow, I did start wanting to fly early in my career because Roswell Air Force Base, now later became Walker Air Force Base, was not too far from one of our ranches. And the flight path of the aircraft going into Walker Air Force Base was right over one of our farms where I live. And so I got interested in aviation very early in my career and started flying. I went out to the local airport, washed airplanes to earn flight time. So I got my pilot's license by the time I was 16 and went off to college. But shortly after that, I went off to college the speaker system or what? Having problem with? Oh, you want to switch? Okay, good enough. Thank you. Went off to college at Carnegie Tech then, Carnegie Mellon now in Pittsburgh, and got a bachelor's degree, was planning on a career in industry, but it so happened that the Korean War was on at that point in time, in the late 40s, early 50s, and so was our draft here in the United States, and I was going to be drafted into the war, and I decided I didn't want that. I wanted to choose my destiny a little better, so I enlisted in the Navy and ended up going through flight school. There we go. And when the Navy flight training in 1953, and from there to carrier training, of course, at the end of that, carrier training in the old airplanes of that period, the SNJ for the Navy, AT-6 for the Air Force, that was our primary trainer in the eras of the 1950. And from that, I ended up eventually aboard carrier in the South Pacific. And the next event we'll talk about was in the Pacific in 1957 at sea aboard an aircraft carrier in jet aircraft. And that's my plane coming back from a flight aboard the carrier. And I was on my way back to the United States for test pilot duty in October of 1957. How many of you remember what happened in October of 1957? Quite a few of you, if you're a little older. In October of 1957 was when Sputnik was launched into near Earth orbit. And that changed my life because I realized that humans would be right behind robot spacecraft. And although I had not planned on a lifetime military career, nor even an aviation career, all of a sudden, things shifted in large measure for me. And I went back to test pilot duty in the Mojave Desert with the Navy and agitating to astronauts had not been selected at that point. They were selected a year later, began the first crew of astronauts were selected. And I was a little young at that point because their requirements were a little older. I was only 27 at that point. And I didn't think I had enough education and not enough flight experience, so I set out to get myself better qualified, and at that point went back to get advanced education and went to graduate school, ended up with a doctorate from MIT, and then on to trying to get better qualified and get into the astronaut program, and eventually ended up in the space pilot training at Edwards Air Force Base, which is a not too far down the road near between here and Los Angeles, and ended up in, while I was teaching in the test pilot school, going through the space portion of this school, and that was what allowed me to get selected into the astronaut program in 1966 into the Apollo program. So there is yours truly with his first official picture in the astronaut program in 1966. And that led, of course, to getting further trained to some of the training was survival training in case we didn't know at that period where the spacecraft necessarily would come down if we wanted it, where we wanted it to come down. So we had to be prepared to survive in the jungle while they came and located us. A little jungle training, learning to eat palm trees and snake and a few other things to survive. But then maybe it came down in the ocean, so we had to do a little survival training aboard a spacecraft bobbing in the ocean. And that was in 1969, shortly before the first lunar landing. And then I was chosen initially on the Apollo 13 crew, but ended up because of Alan Shepard, who was my teammate, had been grounded with Meniere syndrome, an inner ear problem, but had that fixed and came back on flight status in time to fly the Apollo 13 flight with me. But headquarters said, "We think you need a little more training time, Alan. You haven't been training enough since you've been ill. Perhaps you ought to switch missions with Apollo, with Jim Lovell and his crew of Apollo 14. So, somewhat protest, we took Apollo 14, they took Apollo 13, and many of you, I'm sure, have seen the Apollo 13 movie. They got the bad machine, we got lucked out and got the good machine, and we got to land at the Framaro Highlands, that was their original landing site. And so, we had the crew. Our crew was Alan Shepard, commander, myself as lunar module pilot, and Stuart Roosa as the command module pilot. Now, here we see the Apollo 14 spacecraft being moved out to the launch position on Pad B at Cape Kennedy. And I'd like to point out a couple of things to you. Just a large number of you may have never been to the Cape and seen the Apollo Museum, nor seen the spacecraft up close. What you need to see here, look at the humans just standing around there. They're little tiny specks, virtually. Automobiles don't look much bigger. The spacecraft is 363 feet from its base to the command module on the top. And so it's over 3 foot wheel, over 300 feet, 100 yards long, and being moved on this giant trawler out to the launch site. Here we have a picture of it at night. It's a glorious thing to see at night with all the lights on it and a very, very impressive sitting on the launch pad. But then on January the 31st, 1971, we were able to launch Apollo 14 to the Framaro area of the moon. So here we will simulate the launch with these photographs. And take a look as it goes on up. But what I really want to show you is this picture here, which is the first view that an astronaut gets of Earth from space as you rise up out of the atmosphere. And what I want to point out to you right here is the thinness, the fragileness of our atmosphere that envelops our Earth and protects us from the cosmic radiation and the incoming particles from the solar system and from space itself that could be deleterious to Earth, and provides that ozone layer and the mechanism for the global warming that we're also concerned about at this point. But this is what all of us noticed from deep space as you look back at Earth, this very thin layer of atmosphere that surrounds us and keeps us protected. Now we're ready to move on out and destination the moon. And let's take a look at this. I'm sure you remember from your high school physics or astronomy, if you studied that, one face of the moon is always facing Earth. And as we look at the moon, this is the face we always see on a full moon day. And what we always see at these so-called Mare areas, which the ancients thought they were seas, it turns out that they're huge craters, of course, filled with lava rock, and then bombarded over billions of years into very fine powder. So they're called Mare areas from the ancient cartographers that plotted the, that mapped the front side of the moon. But if we take a look at the polar regions, we could see the ruggedness of the terrain, the three-dimensional effect of the craters on the polar areas of the moon. And where we are going on the Fra Mauro mission, on our mission, if you divide the moon vertically and horizontally in half, then the area of Fra Mauro is right just to the left and slightly down, less than a degree, from the center point of the front side of the moon that you can, that we can see from Earth. And we will see, with the help of my good friend Dan over there, we're going to have some nice enhancement video of this in a minute as we get in closer and look at that in a little more detail with modern technology and digital technology. So let's move in closer. Here we go. Move in closer and take a look at the closer view of the cratering on the moon. And you can see this is not so much on the front side. This is a little bit around on the back side where we don't have quite as much smoothness in the Mare areas. But what I'd like for you to see here, these craters are of all sizes. The large ones, which represent very large meteor impacts on the surface of the moon, but even smaller ones all the way down to small ones. And as we see as we land on the moon, we get down to the size of what I called raindrop pattern, where it's just like raindrops speckling the surface of the moon. And, of course, over the billions of years history of the moon, we have swept out a large portion of the meteors in our particular vicinity that would impact either the Earth or the moon. And that's why we have large craters and then smaller craters and smaller craters as meteors of different energies and sizes have plowed into the surface and made these crater impacts. Now the theory is, and I will show this to you a little later as we go further, the theory of meteor impact is that when a meteor hits the surface of the moon, it turns up a huge flap of material like that, lifts it up and blows it away, with the deepest material right on the rim of the crater and the shallowest material stretched out further away from the rim of the crater. And our mission on Apollo 14 was to be the first mission to start scientific exploration of the moon. The first two missions, landing missions, Apollo 11, was simply to show that we could land safely, get down, and get back. The Apollo 12 mission following that was to show we could get down precisely where we wanted to and do useful work and get back. Our mission then, since each mission built upon the success of the past one and extended it further, our mission was to start scientific exploration of the moon and to do a geology traverse across the surface 2 kilometers away from the spacecraft and investigate the ejecta that came out of a little crater called Cone Crater, which is 1,000 feet across and almost 800 feet deep. And the geologists wanted to know what was the material inside the moon that we were looking for. So let's move on around a little bit. And one of the more powerful sights when we first went to the moon was to see our first Earthrise as you come around, go around behind the moon. And, where'd that come from? Okay, there we are. Go around behind the moon and then come out from behind. All of a sudden you see this magnificent planet starting to rise up over the edge of the moon. It's on Earth, we would look at the moon coming up that way, but when you're on the moon, the Earth goes that way. As we come around in this direction toward the moon, toward the Earth, and come around toward the front side, you start to see the softness here of the layers of dust and dirt that have been bombarded, but not nearly as much as when we get fully around on the front side. So with that, we're going to switch over here and take a look at a simulation that Tim is showing us here. And again, we see the front side of the moon and the polar region, and we see the familiar crater that we had in an earlier poll. And now we're moving in, scanning in close to it, and we're going to look at the Fra Mauro area in detail where we're going to land. And this is a digital technology that that Dan put together for us here in the last year or so. We'll move in close, and we see the Fra Mauro area, which is our this particular area right here is where we're looking for. There's the cone crater. It's kind of a hidden right in there. And our landing site is right here beyond Triplet Crater. And where we're going to land is right in here and eventually do a traverse from our landing site up to the top of Cone Crater. And you will see some more film as pictures as we move in close to there. Now we're flipping it around so we can see it from a perspective a little different, and getting in nice and close. Okay, and here we are. Here is our landing site again. Here is Cone Crater that we're going to go up. And this Triplet Crater is really a pattern of three craters that was a very prominent landmark. And we flew right over those, coming in this direction from the east, coming right over those and landing right in this area here. And right now we'll go back to a landing, switch it back. There we go. All right, now we'll go ahead and simulate the landing on with Antares, which is our spacecraft. The name of our spacecraft was Antares, and that was named after the brightest star in the constellation Scorpio, which happened to be our sighting star. Just before we landed on the moon, we had to make sure that our navigation system was aligned and we were seeing everything properly. And when just before we started down, we looked out the telescope, and Antares, our sighting star, should be right in the center of the telescope. Unfortunately, it was. So that was our last sighting, and then we proceeded on down to land at the Fra Mauro Highlands just beyond the Triplet Crater, which was our major landmark to land. If you'll look at this film, at this this picture right now, right here is the flank of Cone Crater. Now, that's the top of it's 2 kilometers away from this landing site. And on our second EVA, extravehicular activity, our job was to go climb up a Cone Crater with our equipment and a little two-wheel cart that you'll see a picture of shortly, and collect samples all the way from the vicinity of the lunar module up to the top of Cone Crater. That was our second extravehicular activity period. The first thing we had to do was the same as with the prior mission. We had to set up a telemetry station and do some experiments on our first extravehicular period, as well as our very first duty was to set up the flag and to take pictures of each of us with the flag to prove that we were there. And you see out across the surface behind us, looking to the west, it's amazing that since the moon is so much smaller than Earth itself, that when you get a little different perspective, you can't quite see it here. You can virtually see the curvature of the moon while you're right on the surface of it. And looking out here, the coloring is about, it's kind of a grayish color, depending upon what angle the sun is, the relative angle of your viewing it. If you look across sun angle, you will get a mouse brown sort of color. If you look down sun, like this one, you will see the gray sort of color that you're seeing right here. This next picture is out in front of the spacecraft. And these are the tracks of our little two-wheeled buggy called the Modular Equipment Transporter, or MET, M-E-T for short. And you'll see a picture of that in a moment. But here off on this side is, here's the sun in the background, and there's the flank of Cone Crater going up that way. And we've out here, about 200 meters away from the spacecraft, is where we set up our telemetry station and our set of scientific experiments. And here's a picture of myself setting up some of the work, and Alan Shepard taking my picture. Here's a shadow of the little two-wheel cart right beside him. That's the antenna for the telemetry station sending signals and data back to Earth, which operated for about 14 years into the 1980s before it was finally shut down. But it was sending data back to Earth continuously for that period. And still out here, I believe that's it right here, that's a laser reflector at that point, which is still in use and still could be used if scientists wanted to send a laser beam to the moon, which they did for quite some time, bounce it off of this laser reflector and be able to gauge, plot the orbit of the moon very accurately and measure within a few centimeters precisely the distance from the Earth's surface to that point on the moon. So that was one of the earliest experiments that allowed us to measure very, very precisely the distance of the Earth to the moon. Okay, here is my partner, Alan Shepard, with our little two-wheel cart that carried our equipment and samples, and we're getting ready to go up Cone Crater on the second EVA. All of this, we had a camera on there. We had a whole host of experimental devices, magnetometers and other devices to go up Cone Crater and make measurements along the way and report back to the scientists on Earth who, in so-called back room at Houston, were watching us do all of this and sending through our CAPCOM suggestions to do this or do that. And we reported back to them verbally exactly what was going on at the time. So let's go on up toward Cone Crater. This is one of the more well-liked pictures of myself looking at a map trying to plot our course up to the top of Cone Crater. We thought it would be a fairly easy thing to do, but unfortunately, due to the cratering, it was much more like being in among the sand dunes in the desert. You couldn't really, whereas the geologist wanted to know precisely where we were at each moment in time. We didn't know precisely where we were because we couldn't see the landmarks over the craters. It was like sand dunes that are about 3 meters high, and it was the next landmark we were looking for was probably at least a couple of sand dunes away and very, very hard to see. So whereas we thought we were making very rapid progress to the top of Cone Crater, it turned out we were going about half the speed we thought we were, and it took us a bit longer to get there. But we did make it to the top of Cone Crater, and here's some pictures as we get closer. You see the terrain gets more rugged, the rock size gets bigger, and here we are very close to the rim, but not quite absolutely at the rim. And the lunar module, you can't see it in this photo, but it's right in that area below the edge of this the horizon of that ridge right there. We're probably about 200 meters away from the edge of Cone Crater. So let's move into the next picture. And this is what the geologists were really looking for. Here was a very good-sized boulder that obviously had come out from deep within Cone Crater. And what they were, one of the things they were interested in, here they had a color variation. They had a white rock. And you can see it's a very much lighter in color than the darker material all around it. And my geology hammer and a little sample bag gives you a mark of size so you can estimate the size of what we're looking at. What we didn't know at that period, at that point, was that we were within about 30 meters or less of the rim of Cone Crater, and we couldn't tell it. So the one disappointment we had, even though we accomplished our mission and got to the top, we did not get a chance to look down into the abyss of Cone Crater. Even though it was just a hop, skip, and a jump away, they caused us to turn back because we were running low on water and oxygen just before, with two or three more leaps, we had been at the edge, and we did not know that. Anyhow, mission accomplished. We started back down the slope to the lunar module, and here I am out at the location of the television camera, and my partner, Alan Shepard, is approaching the lunar module here. The television camera, I was refocusing it so that the people on Earth could get a picture of us going off the surface of the moon. One of the things I wanted to point out here on this one in particular is right outside the lunar module, we have what was called the solar wind collector, and it really is kind of a window shade like. A window shade like device that you pull down and hooked on that staff, and it collected solar particles during the time of our EVA. Then we rolled up the window shade, brought it back, put it in our rock box to bring home. And the reason I show that to you is the golfers in the room will remember that Alan Shepard hit a golf ball on the moon. Well, as a matter of fact, it was the first Lunar Olympics, because when he hit the golf ball, I decided I had to do something also, so I took the staff. I took the staff from that solar wind experiment and threw it after his golf ball. So if you look very carefully here at this crater, you'll see there is the staff, and that was the first javelin throw, and there is the golf ball. So I won the first Lunar Olympics by throwing a javelin further than a golf ball. The only two shots, a golf shot and a javelin throw, constituted the first Lunar Olympics. And if you read the accounts in the history books, Alan was fond of claiming that the golf shot went miles and miles and miles. And as the years went on, it went more miles and miles and miles and miles. And every once in a while, I'd have to have this picture, bring this picture out, and point out that miles and miles was quite enough to describe something that went 50 feet. And so this picture, that crater in front of the lunar module, is roughly 50 feet. It had, this is how far the golf shot went. Two of them got duffed and slugged into the ground, and the third one went out that distance. So that's the funny story of our lunar expedition. The next shot shows us lifting off, starting home. And that's what the lunar module looks like without its descent stage, the feet that we land on, because we leave the descent stage on the surface of the moon. And this is the part that comes up from the surface and headed home. And here we are in the process of starting to leave Earth, leave the moon, and we see a very well-formed crater filled with lava rock, and this one as we come around to the front side of the moon again. And this next one is an interesting geological structure that geologists would have had a great enjoyment looking at. This particular trail on the surface of the moon is somewhat like the Grand Canyon on our Earth. It was a lava tube that carried lava from the internal moon across the surface, and sometime in the distant past it collapsed, leaving this this trail across the moon. The geologists thought that was a very interesting feature. So in any event, there we are on our way starting to come back home, and again we start to get away from the moon, taking a look back at it from a little distance. Now, I want to set this up for you because one of the powerful experiences of going to the moon was the coming home. And being able to, since I was a lunar module pilot and I was responsible for the lunar surface activities and the lunar spacecraft, When we started home, the lion's share of my work was successfully completed, and I could be a little bit more of a tourist and look out the window of the spacecraft. Even though we still had work to do and a spacecraft to fly, I had less work to do, and I could look out and be and revel in the glory of the universe coming home. And let me set this up for you. When we came home, we were flying perpendicular to the ecliptic, or oriented perpendicular to the plane of the ecliptic. And the plane of the ecliptic is that plane which contains the Earth, the Sun, and the Moon. We were flying in it, but oriented perpendicular to it, and we were rotating like this, like on a barbecue spit. As a matter of fact, we called it the barbecue mode. The official name was passive thermal control, because the purpose was to keep thermal balance on the spacecraft. And so we were rotating every 2 minutes. What that caused to happen was that the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and a 360-degree panorama of the heavens appeared out the spacecraft window every 2 minutes. And that was wow. And I'm going to simulate that for you here simply by taking pictures and pretending that we're rotating the spacecraft as we look at them. Now, as we looked at the heavens from the spacecraft on the way home, and the Earth and the Moon, I had a powerful experience, as I realized from my astronomy courses at Harvard and MIT, that the molecules of my body and the molecules in the body of the spacecraft had been prototyped in an ancient generation of stars. We understand that matter, at least the heavy molecular matter above the hydrogen and helium, the heavier molecules are created in the solar furnaces. And I realized that, and suddenly I realized those were my molecules that had been created in some ancient generation of stars. And it became a very, very personal, ecstatic experience. A wow. And I want to point out to you here that what we were seeing in deep space, looking at the heavens, is far greater than anything you can see on Earth, even on the highest mountaintop, without a telescope. You have to have a telescope on Earth to even come close to what we could see with the naked eye in space. What I will be showing you here in these next slides are some photos from the Hubble telescope. Now, if we look through our telescope in space, we could see a lot of what you're seeing here. But it's totally awesome. And if you've looked at any of the pictures from the Hubble telescope, they really blow you away. So here we're going to simulate this barbecue mode or rotation and take a look at what the heavens look like as we come back from the moon. And you can see these galaxies and galactic clusters and the billions and billions and billions of stars, galaxies, galactic clusters. And there's Earth at the distance at that point, far away. More stars and bright lights. Absolutely a magnificent picture. And we've only begun just to tap it a bit and understand very little of what is really out there and what this universe is about. But this happened for 3 days all the way home, every 2 minutes as we were rotating, to get a picture of the heavens and the ecliptic plane and the magnificence of what's there. And then, of course, as we get closer and come in toward Earth, closer to home, then we've got to see the big Earth again like we had in the Apollo 10 photograph. There we go. And then, of course, following that is splashdown as we plunged into the Pacific after 9 days, 1 minute and 40 seconds of being away from our home planet. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the story of my trip to the moon. Thank you. I know I've close to used up my time, but I would like to point out to you that what came out of this was that I realized that we human beings have been asking the question, who are we? How do we get here? Where are we going? What is this really all about? For every generation, since we've had language, since we've been able to pass down from each culture the story of our beginnings, the ancients wondered about who we are, how did we get here, where we're going. My thought, as I was coming back and looking at the heavens from space, was that now that we were beginning spacefaring civilization, we needed to re-ask those questions with the technology and the capabilities that we have on Earth today. And one of the Hubble telescope and the pictures that we have received from that and which you just looked at helped tell quite a new and different story about what is really out there. And it's helping to change the whole picture and our understanding of who we are, how we got here, and what is this really all about. What is dark energy? What is dark matter? I suspect it's going to change our whole cosmology of our understanding of how Earth came to be, how the universe came to be itself. So the next few years are going to be vital, provided, as we're talking about in this conference, we don't destroy ourselves and blow ourselves up with stupidities and war and the sort of behaviors that we humans have exhibited throughout our entire history. We do have a total challenge ahead of us. With that in mind, I would like to end my remarks. I have something that I wrote shortly after coming back that I think bears on the subject. And if you, with your indulgence, I will end my remarks by reading some poetry I wrote on a retreat not long after coming back. I wrote this over 25 years ago. And I think it expresses the sense that we are talking about here. And it is, small human, look up. There is much beyond your tiny world. There is much to know that appears not to your gaze. The vastness of space calls the searching mind. It beckons the seeker to reach out to understand. The vastness of, and splendor of creation. They are yours to know. It waits not, but moves ever onward, going its way. Patterns ever so fine, swirling. Yet not a photon falls upon your eye, but what the process changes. Without you, Earth would not be the same. Different, forever changed in its path, as your movement, thoughts, impact its course. But you change it unaware, knowing not your place in the scheme, endlessly seeking to mold its tides to your will. A will bent to self, accumulating, seizing, discarding, replacing not. Giving not with an eye to beauty and tomorrow, but only to taking more than you can. Small human, look up. There is more to see, more to know about this world. It gives with abundance to those who ravage not. You need not rest your gain, causing all to love, but find harmony with the flow, giving and receiving together the bounty that is there. The universe accepts your caring thoughts and molds itself to a gentle will, yielding to your desires. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think silence is best. Thank you.